You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for January 30th. I'm Joe Elia. Every week we cover what's new and important clinically. Older podcasts and links for all we discuss here are at podcasts.jwatch.org. If something we say moves you to comment, please call 617-440-4374 and comment away. Don't be shy. This week's interview is about a new ranking of antidepressants done in a new way. The week's top clinical headlines. First, antidepressants ranked. Second, Haemophilus death prompts CDC advice on vaccinations. Third, lifetime risks for alcohol problems. And finally, donating kidneys ain't so dangerous. Details. Well, our top story is the subject of our interview. We tracked down two researchers in England and Italy to talk about their new analysis, so keep your headphones on. Next, there was a brace of Haemophilus influenzae type B cases, apparently unrelated to each other, but according to CDC officials, the cases reflect lower herd immunity, as some parents keep their kids out of the vaccination rounds for reasons of their own. The CDC says it's so important to make sure that kids complete their vaccines that they recommend using a combination vaccine if necessary and exposing the child to antigens they've already been vaccinated against. In other words, vaccine shortages or ordering oversights should not be the reason a child in your practice doesn't get vaccinated against HIV. Next, alcohol. Lancet carries an interesting review of alcohol disorders. The author advises that all patients should get screened for unhealthy drinking. But here's what caught our eye. The fact that men have a lifetime risk of having an alcohol abuse disorder of more than 20%, 15% risk for abuse, and about 10% for alcohol dependence. Yikes. Get screening. Finally, kidneys. Donating one isn't going to affect your long-term health, it seems. A study from NEJM this week follows up with some 3,700 kidney donors who had nephrectomies at the University of Minnesota between 1963 and 2007. Their mortality rates matched those in the general population, and their rate of end-stage renal disease was lower. However, the sample was almost entirely white, and both authors and an accompanying editorial are skittish about extrapolating these results to the general population. Okay, on to the interview. Lancet has just published online a meta-analysis of 12 newer generation antidepressants, finding sertraline and escitalopram to have the best profiles in terms of efficacy and patient acceptance. The researchers used a newer method of analysis called multiple treatments meta-analysis to arrive at their conclusions. The analysis included 117 randomized control trials, which comprised totally almost 26,000 patients. An editorial also published online says the result is a new gold standard of reliable information. We've asked two of the study's authors, Dr. Andrea Cipriani of the University of Verona and Professor John Geddes of the University of Oxford, to chat with us today about their work. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
It's nice to have you here. Can you tell us a little bit about the technique that you used to analyze the studies and how it differs from a standard meta-analysis?
Well, the technique is quite new, and this is the first meta-analysis we run with this method in psychiatry, which is called multiple treatments meta-analysis. It's new because it combines both direct and indirect evidence, merging results into one point estimate. Just let me explain how it works.
Sure.
If you have a trial comparing drug A versus drug B, and a second trial comparing drug B versus drug C, this technique allows us to compare drug indirectly, drug A versus drug C, even though we don't have a trial which direct compares drug A versus drug C.
I see. So it's by analogy,
on the assumption that the designs are equally robust in both trials?
Yes, we can say that direct evidence has a different weight from indirect evidence. We use a so-called Bayesian approach, and we needed a statistician, a well-trained statistician from Greece and from Cambridge, the University of Cambridge, to do this. But this is how it works, merging together with these two kind of results and waiting for them.
Have you developed this method of meta-analysis yourselves, or is this in the literature?
It's in the literature since 10 years, more or less. There is a huge debate in terms of the how to run this kind of analysis. There are different approaches, and this technique that is in development, and we use with the trained statisticians who are worldwide known for this kind of analysis, but it's a technique in development. Yeah,
if I could just pitch in there, I mean, the sort of idea of indirect analyses has been around for perhaps a decade or so, but it's a field that's developing quite quickly. I mean, we published a meta-analysis in 2000 on atypical antipsychotics, and we did incorporate an indirect analysis in that. But it was at a sort of much simpler, less sophisticated level. This is using a full Bayesian approach to weight the evidence between the multiple treatment comparisons within the analysis. And so it's a much more sophisticated approach and probably much more robust approach than we've been able to do previously. So we've used the kind of cutting edge of this technology, but it is still developing.
I see. Well, given the newness of the technique, it's a decade old, how comfortable are you with the applicability of the findings?
Well, the applicability of the findings depends on the quality of the data we retrieved from the individual trials, most of all. So this evidence needs to be updated on a routine basis. However, this is randomized evidence, so this is the best available evidence we have today on which to base our clinical conclusions.
In general, the sort of methodological studies have looked at the reliability of the indirect comparisons compared to direct comparisons, suggest that there's still some uncertainty. And it's probably best to say that this is the best we can possibly do at the moment on the basis of the existing evidence. Obviously, ideally, you would have direct comparisons between all drugs. We simply don't have that, and therefore, this is the way of doing it. And as it stands, and as the sort of methodological studies suggest, it's probably pretty reliable that the estimates from the indirect studies are usually fairly close to those that you get from directly randomized studies. It differs a bit on the individual areas, and of course it differs on the sort of biases, as Andrea says, that are in the primary studies that go into the analysis. That's probably a bigger determinant of the reliability. And of course this is an area where there have been concerns about the reliability of some of the studies, but more about whether they were made available or whether there was publication bias.
So you feel like you've resolved a question then. Is that fair to say practitioners should be following this advice?
Yeah, I think so. I think that we're sufficiently convinced of the robustness of the analysis, the primary trials, and the results to suggest that this is worthwhile guiding practice with.
Well, that was quite an editorial. Don't you agree? It was glowing.
It was, yeah.
I've read a lot of medical literature, and I don't encounter too many like that. And it seemed to me that. If you weren't convinced, then the editorialist is convinced that people should be using these data and your analysis to make some clinical decisions and rather soon.
I agree. This is Dr. Parikh's editorial, and I think he actually pulls out most of the points that we feel are key in the results and the analysis we publish. So, I mean, I very much agree. Though, of course, I mean, he's emphasized those issues. As authors, as cautious authors, you tend to be quite conservative about the weight that you put on your findings. But, yeah, he's emphasized the points that I think are the best thing, the most important things to draw out. And as we've said, this is probably the best methodological approach one can take to this clinical question about are the differences between antidepressant medicines at the moment. So I think if you don't base your practice on this kind of analysis, then what do you base it on? It's the best we've got.
You suggest using sertraline as the standard comparator drug in future trials of antidepressants, and the editorialist and you yourselves identify that suggestion as perhaps a bit controversial. Has anyone come back at you saying, no, we shouldn't be doing it this way?
Not yet, but we anticipate that we will. I mean, this is a hotly debated area, obviously, about whether in a clinical area one has treatments that are known to be effective and safe, it is scientifically justified or ethical to continue doing placebo-controlled trials. In general, in this field, it's been that the consensus is that it is, because there's sufficient uncertainty about the effects of individual drugs. And also, there are difficulties in interpreting active versus active drugs without a placebo, i.e., you know, if there's no difference observed between the drugs, does it mean that both don't work, both do work? So as a kind of internal guarantor of validity or measure of validity, a kind of so-called assay sensitivity, the placebo is seen as being a very important component. I guess our view here is that if you have now got pretty good evidence that one drug, or indeed there are differences between drugs, and one seems to be quite a good standard treatment, perhaps the emphasis should be more on active versus active comparators without a placebo arm. That's not to say that we don't need placebo-controlled trials. I think at an early stage of drug development, there probably still is a place.
Yes.
But in fact, for future drug development, what I want to see as a what I would want to see as a patient, and I do want to see as a clinician, is I want to see drugs that offer real benefits over the drugs we've already got. We've got a lot of drugs, and I want ones that are either more effective or better tolerated than the existing ones. And really, to do that, we need to focus on the active-active comparison. And of course, doing placebo-controlled trials in an area where there are available treatments is fraught with problems, which means that, you know, you get very very highly selected patients participating in those trials, because many clinicians and patients simply wouldn't want to participate in a placebo-controlled trial on their active treatments. Now, it's all part of that debate, and we think this sort of adds to the argument that we could do with having more non-placebo-controlled trials.
It seems from your analysis that there are some drugs, or at least one, that isn't working very well at all as an antidepressant. But some of those drugs will probably be used only in certain circumstances now, if the standard is going to be sertraline and escitalopram. Is that right?
Andrea, do you want to say that?
Yeah. Yes, we looked at all antidepressants that we know have been approved, and so they should work. They work, and they should work. What we found is that not all antidepressants are the same, but we focused our analysis on the treatment of major depression, moderate to severe major depression, as acute treatment. So this is the clinical bottom line and the target people. However, yes, we found that some drugs that are still on the market are possibly less effective and less acceptable than the others. So, for instance, reboxetine was the one you were mentioning before.
Yes.
And we don't know what it will be in the next future. However, we believe that this article, this evidence, can change clinical practice somehow, yeah.
I
guess that, I mean, obviously, if you take the results of the recent STAR-D trial, in the States, it found that the response rate to the first-line therapy is often rather disappointingly low. So there's certainly a role for more than one or two drugs in the treatment of depression, because people's response is difficult to predict and is often idiosyncratic according to individual drugs. Now, reboxetine obviously has a different mechanism of action than the SSRIs, so it's still likely to be of use in those people who haven't responded to an SSRI. But as we argue, you know, what this analysis was trying to pick out was really, well, what's the best bet in terms of average efficacy and acceptability to use in the first-line treatment of depression? And I suppose our results wouldn't favor using reboxetine in that particular situation. For patients who are currently taking drugs that aren't sertraline and citalopram and getting benefit from them, obviously we wouldn't advise them to stop their drugs very suddenly. I mean, the important thing is that all these drugs have been shown to work individually. And the differences on are relatively small, but we think worthwhile.
What's next? What's next for your group? Do you have other studies underway that you can talk about at this point?
Well, we think that based on this particular study, of course, and we allude to this at one point, is that if you've got drugs that are generically available and aren't branded, then they're probably going to be cheaper. But this is a very simplistic way of looking at the economics of treating depression. So what we're trying to do at the moment is a sort of full-scale economic analysis, which would allow a more sophisticated way of guiding the choice of antidepressants. But we felt the results were sufficiently robust at this point to publish them. So we're trying to do this economic analysis at the moment. And, of course, we're thinking now of applying the same kind of multiple treatments method because it's been informative in this particular situation in a range of other areas within psychiatry and the treatment of mental disorders, thinking particularly of, you know, treatments with the antipsychotics in a range of conditions. So yeah, we're sort of setting up a program of this kind of work, which will be keep the existing collaborative group of international researchers together and see if we can shed light on a few areas of clinical practice.
Well, I look forward to your future studies, and I want to thank you, Dr. Cipriani and Professor Geddes, for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you very much.
Finally this week, I've been overwhelmed with suggestions for renaming our podcast, but I'm ignoring all that sound too clinical. I mean, do you really want to listen to something called Clinical Conversations or Unresolved Clinical Issues? No, of course not. When the chief of medicine asks why you're wearing headphones and smiling at the computer and suspects you're on Skype with your significant other, you can say honestly, "No, ma'am, I'm listening to Goat Rodeo." At least that's what I'm calling it this week. If you'd like to compete or just place a bet, call 617-440-4374. We'll see you next time. The executive producer of Goat Rodeo is Adore Yano. And I'm Joe Ilya, riding in a roping. Yeehaw! Join us next week, partner, and we'll have more to tell you about this medicine thing.